From NPR News, this is Weekends on All Things Considered. Guy Raz is away. I'm Laura Sullivan. Americans are counting their pennies these days, taking a close look at everything from the cost of milk to their mortgage. And that means it's time for the age-old question.
For years, we've been told the surest way to make more money is to invest in yourself by getting a college degree. But with the cost of college rising faster than inflation,
many are now asking,
is college worth the price of admission?
Is college worth
the cost? Is college really
worth it?
Is college really worth it? Or is it the big lie?
College does cost three times as much as it did 30 years ago. But since World War II, a house and a degree has been the American dream, a sign you've made it. In 2009, more than 70% of high school graduates enrolled in college, almost twice as many as in 1960. Could so many people be wrong? That's our cover story today. Why do we continue to question the value of a college diploma?
What you see, if you look at the news stories over time, and really going all the way back to the 1970s when they first started to appear, is that a real formula has emerged over time.
Kevin Carey is policy director for the education sector, an education policy think tank here in Washington, D.C. He could write a college graduate horror story in his sleep.
You start with some kind of very alarming, attention-grabbing headline.
College graduates may be no better equipped for the work world than high school students.
And then you find a recent college graduate in the worst possible circumstances to lead off your story.
Chris Alfred followed the crowd at his high school and went to college and grad school. Now he owes more than $125,000.
The key is to find someone who just graduated from college, who's working in a terrible job.
I work at a call center and I make $10 an hour. And I feel like a loser.
And living in just the most abject circumstances. They're on food stamps. They've moved back in with their parents, much to their parents' alarm.
I'm just about broke and I'm about to graduate. So it's time to pack it up and go back and spend some of my mom and dad's money.
And then from there, you sort of start to broaden the thesis.
Everybody is nervous.
And say something like, people are increasingly questioning whether college is worth it.
A recent survey asked thousands of students at hundreds of colleges, would you go to your school again? About 40% said they would not.
You track down an expert.
The bachelor's degree, it's America's most overrated product.
And then you finish with a quote saying, my life is terrible, I'm in a dead-end job, I'm sad, I'm hungry.
Frankly, I'll take what I can get because right now I need money.
What is to become of me?
We'll get back to Kevin Carey in a minute, but first, one woman's story that sounds pretty familiar from two decades ago. In 1989, Melissa Burke headed out to the University of Florida, even though people told her it might not help her get a job. And when she graduated 4 years later, it was pretty bleak.
There was a lot of kind of static or tension in the air around whether or not we were going to be able to find good jobs that would really set us on our way for careers.
It was the middle of a recession. She started to look for work early.
So my friend and I decided just to head out and see the country and really face the career issue or the lack of jobs or whatever in the fall rather than deal with it right off the bat in May. So when I started looking, there were a lot of resumes sent out and a lack of calls back and a lack of interviews. And I was very aware of the struggle or the perceived struggle in terms of landing that first job and starting off on that career path. You know, I remember hearing the stories. I mean, I was featured in an article that the headline was Grads Without Jobs.
You wouldn't know from that 1993 Washington Post headline that things were about to take a turn for Melissa Burke, which you'll hear in a minute. And that's one of the things that drives Kevin Carey crazy. He's the policy director at the education sector. And when we talked, I asked him, what's so bad about this kind of story?
It's missing a lot of really important long-term trends. If you look at wage data, people with college degrees are making more and more and more money. And basically everyone else is either staying the same or falling back. So the economy has expanded a lot, but basically college graduates are the people who have reaped the benefits of that, and non-college graduates have really struggled to stay ahead.
So, why do we love this storyline so much?
Well, I think the kind of people who read the New York Times and the Washington Post tend to be more college educated. And so this really tweaks their anxieties. If you're a parent and you've spent your whole life trying to get your son or daughter into a good college and spent a lot of money, the last thing you want to hear is that that was a bad idea and they're going to be coming home and they'll be unemployed soon. And so people gravitate towards stories that speak to their fear and their anxieties.
So, I mean, we've heard this story over and over again, this question, is college worth it? But it seems to really have hit a nerve lately. I mean, you have venture capitalist Peter Thiel paying kids, paying kids to skip college. Why is it taking off so much right now?
We always see a spike in this kind of story during economic downtimes because, of course, when there's a recession, it's harder for everyone to find a job, including college graduates. Although, again, I would note that even in this most recent terrible recession, college graduates were less likely to be unemployed before it started, and they were less likely to lose their jobs after the recession happened. And in fact, only college graduates, they're the only segment of the economy where employment has actually gotten better during the first 5 months of this year. But the other reason I think that there's this level of anxiety is that college is much, much more expensive than it used to be. So when people are wrestling with that cost-benefit equation, the cost part of it has gotten bigger and bigger, and so their sense of how much the benefits ought to be has risen as well.
So what do you say to people who feel like they have just been cheated by the higher education system?
It is possible to be cheated by the higher education system. We've seen a lot of intention in Washington, D.C. over the last year about abuses in the for-profit higher education industry. The Obama administration took action just a couple of weeks ago, in fact, to put in new regulations that would prevent predatory for-profit colleges from inducing students to take out tens of thousands of dollars in loans for degrees that often have little value in the job market. This is not to say that everything is totally fine and that any college will always be worth it. But the long-term trends about the average value of a college degree are very strong.
Is that what the economists say, too?
Economists like to argue with one another, and so there is some dispute in the field about this. But you look at somebody like, for example, there's a labor economist at Georgetown University named Anthony Carnevale who has calculated that on our current pace, we are going to produce 3 million fewer college graduates by 2018 than the economy will demand. That if you look
at the new fewer.
So we're not producing enough right now. And that's because if you look at the fastest growing job categories, they tend to be jobs that require some level of post-secondary education. And we have this continuing phenomenon of old jobs that have been around a long time being redefined upward in terms of the skills that they require. And employers will be looking for those people with degrees.
That's Kevin Carey, policy director of a think tank called the Education Sector. He joined us from member station KUOW in Seattle. Kevin, thank you.
Thank you.
Remember Melissa Burke? Well, what Carey said about a college degree paying off in the end was true for her.
So I saw an ad in the paper for a job of desktop publisher, secretary. I applied for that job, got it. And I think, you know, for me, it was not my ideal career path. You know, I didn't go to college for 4 years to be a secretary. But I really saw it as an opportunity to start working in the field, you know, that I knew I wanted to be in. I started out, I was supporting the director of membership and communications. And, you know, 5 years later, I had her job. So taking that, you know, initial step of doing a job that maybe I perceived as less than ideal really, you know, was the first step to kind of, you know, starting my career.
Melissa Burke now runs her own HR consulting firm in Silver Spring, Maryland.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon. Time for sports. And what a lineup. Golf, a near-perfect performance to behold yesterday at the U.S. Open. Tennis, Wimbledon starts on Monday. Baseball, the stars might be realigning. Howard Bryant joins us from Amherst, Massachusetts. Howard, thanks for being with us.
Scott, how are you? Good morning.
Good morning. And, wow, let me ask you about that round that Rory McIlroy had yesterday at Congressional Country Club. 22 years old, leads by 6 strokes headed into today. But, of course, we remember what happened at the Masters when he kind of came apart, and his last hole yesterday was double bogey.
It was double bogey, exactly. But that's the negative in you, Scott. You got to think of the positive here. It's an amazing story. 22 years old, and if you think about where golf has been, especially with the big guy not being there anymore, it's a wonderful thing for the sport, considering that this is what golf needs. And especially yeah. going into the final weekend, you've got two rounds for him to hold on to a six-shot lead. And it was eight shots before the double bogey. But post-Tiger, I don't yeah. think the sport could ask for anything more.
Let me ask you about Wimbledon, because the Williams sisters both have designs on making a comeback after both of them struggling against prolonged injuries. What's their prognosis?
Well, when they're in the tournament, they are always going to be favorites. And I think it's great for tennis. Obviously, we're talking about golf with star power. This is exactly what the women's game needs. You've got this dearth of players. And I know that the French Open was fantastic for Lina. One thing that I really enjoy about this, not only are the Williams sisters back, which is what the sport needs, mm-hmm. but believe it or not, in that game where you can't, where you're ancient at age 25, the women's game is being dominated right now by players who are nearing 30. Venus is 30, Serena's 29, mm-hmm. Lina is 29, and Francesca Schiavone is 30 years old. And so for all the ancients out there at age 30, you can actually pick up a racket and think you can win.
And let me ask the annual question on the men's side, because we have, of course, familiar names, Federer, Nadal, Djokovic, Andy Murray. The pride of Britain. The hope of Britain.
The hope of Britain.
Does he have a chance?
I think he's got a chance, and he was wonderful last year until Roger Federer broke the run. But I feel this is a three-person race on the men's side. Andy Murray is so close, and I think he's going to go down in history maybe as one of the greatest players never to win a major because of those three guys, Federer, Nadal, Djokovic. Nobody can crack that right now because they are so much better than the next four, five, six than Murray, Soderling, and Berdych. And it's kind of sad for Andy Murray, but if he's going to be a great player eventually, you've got to beat one of those three guys. No matter what tournament you're in, you're yeah. going to have to beat one of them or probably two of them.
I want to get you to talk now about the prospect of major league realignment. Bud Selig, the commissioner, is said to be contemplating that, maybe on the verge of announcing something. What's behind the shakeup? What do you foresee?
Well, I think the first thing baseball wants is two more playoff teams. There's no question about that. I think that the sport honestly believes that even though you have a 162-game season, even though the reason that only a few teams make the playoffs is to give value to that 162, I mean, what is the point? What is the point of playing baseball all summer long if everyone's going to make the playoffs in October? I think baseball feels a bit of pressure that it's not the other sports in terms of having a big tournament at the end. However, two 15-team leagues really doesn't make a lot of sense if you're a team. How do you sell to your season ticket holders that, yeah, we didn't make the playoffs and we were in 14th place last year? It just doesn't quite yeah. sound right. I think that you can add two playoff teams without doing something so radical, because I think cosmetically, at least, it gives your fan base a bad feeling if you say we were 10th last year.
Mm-hmm. All right, Howard Bryant, senior writer for ESPN.com, ESPN the magazine. You've got a wonderful piece running there, by the way, about the future of the Oakland A's.
And don't forget about those Boston Bruins winning the Stanley Cup, Scott.
Oh, I didn't pay attention. Nice to talk to you, Howard.
You too, Scott.
Some of the nation's biggest power tool companies are gearing up for a fight. This week they sent their executives to Washington, D.C. to argue against tougher safety mandates for so-called table saws. Those are the ones with large, open, spinning blades. Every year, 4,000 Americans suffer amputations in table saw accidents. NPR's Chris Arnold has this reporter's notebook.
About 7 years ago, I was flying on an airplane, and I was thumbing through a woodworking magazine. And in the back of it, I came across a little ad for a table saw that wouldn't cut off your fingers. And that sounded like a pretty good kind of saw to me. I like doing home improvement projects, and it also just sounded like something that was pretty cool and interesting. So when I got home, I called up the inventor, and it turned out that he had a pretty amazing story to tell. I found out that table saws cause thousands of these really horrible injuries every year, and this inventor, a guy named Steve Gass, had actually figured out a way to prevent just about all of those accidents. And over the years, he's proved that it works. Bob Adler is a commissioner at the Consumer Product Safety Commission, which was holding meetings on the issue this week.
What you have is somebody who has invented a dramatic technology that seems to reduce virtually all the injuries associated with table saws.
Steve Gass, the inventor, likes to demonstrate how this saw works by using a hot dog. At one point, he showed this to me at a high school shop class out in Oregon.
I'm going to put this hot dog on top of the board here as if it was my thumb misplaced in the path of the blade. And then I'm going to shove it into the blade and all.
Gass's saw uses an electrical sensor to detect when the blade touches flesh instead of wood. And within a few thousandths of a second, the blade slams to a stop.
All right, we're good to go. Everybody ready? All right. Ready?
But as well as the technology works, the major power tool companies have failed to put this kind of device on any of their table saws, even 10 years after Steve Gass offered to license it to them.
They came back and said, well, we've looked at it, but we're not interested because safety doesn't sell.
Gass's little upstart company, in the meantime, has sold tens of thousands of these safer table saws. And lately, things have been heating up in Washington. The National Consumers League, it's a consumers group, last month brought in injured woodworkers to meet with lawmakers and regulators. They want to make the SawStop safety break mandatory on all table saws. So just this week, I was back in Washington in a hearing room. Susan Young represents Black & Decker, Bosch, Makita, and other power tool companies.
SawStop is currently available in the marketplace to any consumer who chooses to purchase it.
In other words, let consumers decide. And Susan Young says many consumers won't want to pay for the SawStop technology, which could add between $100 to $300 or more in cost, depending on which side you talk to. Either way, the gears are now turning in Washington. By the end of September, regulators say they'll issue a draft of new safety requirements for table saws. Chris Arnold, NPR News.
You probably know the song, an instant hit on its release in 1975, reborn when Freddie Mercury died, revived by a carload of headbanging slackers in Wayne's World. It's Queen's opera-inspired Bohemian Rhapsody, back in the spotlight again. It's been named the UK's favorite pop song ever by listeners of the BBC. I'm just a The meaning and inspiration behind Bohemian Rhapsody has been debated for decades. Music writer Alan Connor, who's also a freelance for the BBC, joins us now from London with his own interpretation. Thanks so much for being with us.
What a pleasure to be with you to talk about this song.
Let's listen to the verse where people can begin to get just a little, begin to scratch our heads. I see a little silhouette of a man. Scaramouche, Scaramouche, will you do the fandango? Thunderbolt and lightning, very, very frightening me. Galileo. Okay, Scaramouche, Fandango, Galileo.
Magnifico.
Why, is it just like nice nonsense words as it would be in a children's story, Dr. Seuss or something?
I don't think so. I think you can kind of look at each of the odd words, and I think they make sense in context. Scaramouche is a stock character from the 16th century Italian art form Commedia dell'arte, which is a boastful character who's ultimately put down and humiliated by the other characters. So if you listen to that middle section as a trial, the central character who's killed the person is being yelled at and humiliated by these strange singing judges.
While we're speaking of Freddie Mercury, I guess I didn't know until just a few moments ago that he was Parsi, born in Zanzibar.
Yeah.
Which could explain another lyric, right? Bismillah, no,
we will not let you go. He was of Parsi heritage, and one of the other nice-sounding words in there is Bismillah, which is an Arabic way of invoking God's name and asking him to intervene. So it's a word that Freddie would have been familiar with from his upbringing, and I would say it fits again in the song. He's saying, oh my God, help me.
Well, why do you think the song endures after all these years?
The thing about it is it's sheer sonic bombast. There's so many parts to it that you're bound to have a favourite bit, whether it's the kind of head-banging bit or the opera or the quiet bits at the start and the end.
Alan Connor, music writer, speaking with us from London. Thanks so much.
Thank you very much. Nothing really matters to me.
This is NPR News.
America's largest rivers have wreaked havoc throughout the South and Midwest this spring, inundating towns and farmland from South Dakota to Louisiana. Nature is responsible for most of it, thanks to huge winter snowpacks and historic spring rain. But some of the flooding is not, in fact, natural. It's controlled by the Army Corps of Engineers.
Fire in the hole!
Fire in the hole!
That's the sound of the Corps blowing up a levee along the Mississippi River last month and releasing water that swamped hundreds of miles of Louisiana farmland to save the city's downriver. The big problem now is up north, along the Missouri River in South Dakota and Iowa. The Corps had been holding water back in reservoirs to protect people and businesses downstream, but those reservoirs are now full. And with 3 to 5 inches of rain forecast this weekend, the Army Corps has, for the first time in history, opened all emergency outlets on 6 dams beyond their maximum recommended flows. Many homes and farms along the Missouri River are already underwater. Farmer Don Diltz in Glenwood, Iowa, was one of the first to feel the effects.
This isn't something normal. This isn't something that I believe any generation before us has ever seen.
Diltz says his farm will be covered in water for at least 6 months. The decision, who gets wet and who stays dry, is one of the toughest the Army Corps of Engineers has to make. Mike Parker was Assistant Army Secretary who oversaw the Corps in 2000. He says he never had to deal with anything like this.
Well, it's just unprecedented, the amount of flooding. It's unprecedented the amount of damage that's been done. The system in the Mississippi River worked exactly like it should have. They flooded farmland, which is a terrible thing, but they didn't flood towns.
So when you look at sort of the Missouri River coming down and then flowing into the Mississippi and then the Mississippi flowing down, this is...
Well, Missouri's different.
The Missouri's different?
Well, Missouri's a political animal.
How so?
And that is much, much different. Several years ago, Congress decided, you had a lot of these interests out there, and these interests got together and said, we're not being represented. And so they put together, they started a process which wound up being the Missouri Master Manual. And it was finalized in 2004. So instead of having navigation and flood control as being the two primary things that the Corps was looking at, they had a list of 8 things that they had to consider. Irrigation, water supply, hydropower, fish and wildlife, recreation, and water quality. Well, some of these 8 things are counter to each other.
A lot of the folks that I've talked to up in South Dakota feel very passionately that the Corps should have been releasing the water all along, that it shouldn't have gotten to the point where these reservoirs are about to break.
Then the Master Manual should have taken that into consideration. If the Corps only had to take care of navigation and flood control, I guarantee you those levels would have been much lower.
We had heard that one of the reasons that they didn't open the floodgates up in South Dakota was because they didn't want to add any more water into the Mississippi.
Yeah. I mean, we're hurting down there, and you have to understand. General Mike Walsh had to make a decision to open the floodgates at Morganza. When he opened those floodgates, he had to stand in front of people and say, people, I'm opening these floodgates, and by the way, I'm going to flood all of you when I do that. We're sorry. These are the choices. None of these are easy choices. If it were easy, you wouldn't be interviewing me today.
That's Mike Parker, formerly the Assistant Secretary of the U.S. Army, overseeing the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers, and currently head of the lobbying firm Welch Resources. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
I'm Laura Sullivan, and I'm standing here at the Capitol Hill Flea Market in Washington, D.C., and I'm here with someone who really knows a lot about this kind of place. Her name is Maureen Stanton, and she's written a book called Killer Stuff and Tons of Money, Seeking History and Hidden Gems in Flea Market America, and we're going to see if we can find some of those hidden gems today. And we should say that we're taping this first thing in the morning. We're here pretty early, but we're already late. I mean, really, this is late.
This is late. For a flea market that opens to the public at 8 o'clock, the dealers are here sometimes right at the crack of dawn when the lights are unpacking, and they're trading amongst each other. I mean, the antique dealers generally are picking the other tables. They call it picking the field or picking the tables, looking for the thing that they can resell for, you know, double or triple or tenfold.
One of the things that really came out in your book is that this going on here is an entire subculture to itself. I mean, these are people that are traveling the majority of the year. They're up, you know, they work 80 to 100 hours a week. They have to sell, they have to buy constantly. And there's it's got its own kind of underground kind of culture going on.
And there is. There's a, just like any subculture, there's a language and there's a knowledge base. Some antique dealers just, they have shops, but they'll come out and do big shows several times a year.
The main character in your book, who's you give the name of Kurt Avery to, Kurt Avery was able to run through the flea market. He would get there first thing in the morning, I mean, hours before anybody else even showed up. And he would be able to run through in 15, 20 minutes, just pick exactly the items that could resell, $5 item for $100, in some cases $100 or $200 item that he resold for thousands of dollars. And he makes it look really easy, like, oh, we can all just show up and go grab these items. But it's actually not easy at all. I mean, how would you describe his job?
Well, he's at this point now where he has developed this knowledge. So I call it his antique laser vision lens. And he can look at a batch of things and he can find the thing that's valuable. He can tell right away. But it's taken him 15 to 20 years to get there. And he has a house full of mistakes, as he'll say. You buy the thing and you take it to someone who's more knowledgeable. You say, check this out, what do you think? And the person will say, well, that's a repro, that's not real, or this is cracked, or this isn't the one you want because it's not the right form or the right color.
How much do you think Kurt Avery makes every year?
It probably varies, but he's probably making, you know, maybe, say, $80,000, something like that.
$80,000? I mean, that's a lot of money.
It's a lot of money, but don't forget he has to pay for the objects, so there's the cost of the objects, and sometimes he's making 10 times what he paid. Sometimes it's just double, you know.
And, of course, there's the hours. I mean, he was on the road three quarters of the year. I mean, he was sleeping in his car, sleeping in a tent. You know, he was working 80 to 120 hours a week.
And he's really driven. He's, you know, and he's driven both by just his ethic of, you know, workaholic kind of thing, but he's also driven by the passion. And, you know, when you think about it, that if you have that knowledge now that you might find that thing worth 50 or 100 or even more, I think that, you know, you want to be out there looking because that could be the day.
In one case, he did walk by a really, really great item four or five times in the day.
And that was a shaker piece. It was a yarn winder. The shakers used to make their own yarn out of fleece.
And we should say that the shakers were an 18th century religious sect that made some really exquisite furniture.
Furniture and, you know, many objects. And so he walked by this yarn winder four or five times, and many other knowing dealers, very knowledgeable dealers, walked by it. And he eventually looked at it a little closer for a minute, thought, it looks good, has nice paint, I might be able to get $300 for it. That was priced at $90. When he looked at it closer a little bit later, he thought, this looks like it could be a shaker-made object. So he discerned that it was shaker, and he brought it to an auction, a specialty shaker auction, and he was able to sell it for $6,500. So
that's
for $90, it's a good profit, but to make a living, you've got to do that 20 times a year. And so that knowledge paid off. Shaker objects go for hundreds of thousands of dollars.
So I'm talking to Maureen Stanton, author of Killer Stuff and Tons of Money, and we're here at the Capitol Hill Flea Market. Let's go talk to this guy, because he looks sort of interesting. What is your name?
My name is Jim Tam.
Jim Tam.
But I'm called the Map Man. That was the name given me by the people who came by.
It looks like you have hundreds? Thousands?
Here I have probably hundreds, yeah.
Hundreds of maps,
yes,
here in,
yeah,
this booth. Well, this is Maureen Stanton. She wrote a book about how to shop at flea markets and sort of the culture of flea markets and the passion for the old items.
Oh.
And this is sort of exactly what she was writing about.
Oh,
is,
yeah,
this? You have a passion for these maps.
I would do this anyway. I would be doing this in my front lawn probably. Sadly. But no, I'm one of these people that had boxes of things floor to ceiling before I did this. People like that need a store, okay? That's the answer. So I now have my little store.
Maureen, you talked about this occupational hazard that a lot of dealers have. What did you find?
Well, I found that a lot of people get into the business because they're supporting their own habit. And so they'll sell other things they don't want or lesser things as they move up the ranks and their objects that they collect. But it's a passion. But I feel like the collectors and the antique dealers are each their little curators, preserving a little part of American culture and history.
Maureen Stanton, author of Killer Stuff and Tons of Money, and you can find all of her tips on how to shop at flea markets at npr.org. Maureen, thank you so much for coming out shopping with us today.
Thank you. It's always a pleasure to go to a flea market.